Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Well, this is not Bach. It's actually machine-created music composed by EMI, or Experiments in Musical Intelligence, a computer program by David Cope. But how close is it to the real thing? Does the AI get the emotion of Bach right? And if so, does that mean that we're at the dawn of an age of magnificence in artificial intelligence, say, as described by Ray Kurzweil?
By 2029, computers would have all of the intellectual and emotional capabilities of humans.
Or are we at a terrifying darkness, as envisioned by Stephen Hawking?
I think the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race.
Is there hope or horror in the near future of artificial intelligence? Well, computer science professor Melanie Mitchell gives us a realist survey of the current and near state of AI. Not quite the Terminator or HAL just yet, but she also says now is the time to grapple with the moral and ethical questions raised by AI. What exactly is it? And what does that mean about who we are? This hour on Point, artificial intelligence and what it means to be human. And you can join us. Developing AI has taught us a lot about human intelligence. What do you think it means? What do you think it has taught us about being a thinking person? Join us anytime on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us from Vancouver, Canada, where she's attending a machine learning conference, is Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University, and her new book is called Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. Professor Mitchell, welcome to On Point.
Thanks. I'm glad to be here.
I'm delighted to have you. I really enjoyed reading your book. We set up the hour this way using that music from EMI because of the way that you start the book about when you tell a story about when you visited Google's headquarters with your mentor, a very famous person in the world of computer science. Can you tell us that story?
Yes. So my PhD advisor was Douglas Hofstadter, who wrote a book called Gödel, Escher, Bach back in the 1970s. And it was an extremely popular book that launched the career of thousands of people in AI. And in about 5 years ago, Hofstadter was invited to a meeting at Google to talk to their AI researchers. And he brought me along, which was a great thing for me. But we had this meeting, and he got up and gave a talk about how terrified he was about AI, which kind of shocked everyone because most of the people in the room had gone into AI because of reading his book. And one of the reasons that he was so terrified was precisely this computer program called EMI, or Experiments in Musical Intelligence, written by David Cope, which produced the music that you heard at the beginning.
But what was so scary about it to him?
Well, for him, music, and particularly classical music, the music of Bach, Chopin, etc., is the essence of the human spirit. It's what makes us human, is being able to create beautiful, profound pieces of art, literature, and other expressions of our humanity. And the idea to him that a computer, using what he called cheap tricks, could produce this kind of beautiful music that was hard to distinguish from the real thing was just terrifying to him. And it made him feel that his humanity, in some sense, was cheapened.
Right. So that's the key distinction, right? His terror, as you write it, wasn't necessarily so much that, you know, super machines may take over humankind in the near future, but rather that if we can create machines or artificial intelligence that can create the kind of music that we heard, that it sort of laid bare how rudimentary and how simple we are as human beings?
Exactly. We pride ourselves on having a complex intelligence, a sort of deep and profound spirit that is exhibited in these kinds of creations. And the idea that computers could take over that most essential part of humanity is terrifying. I don't think that we're anywhere close to that yet, but that was what Doug Hofstadter was particularly worried about.
So even if we're not close to that yet, do you share his overall concern about what advances in AI might mean about who we are?
To me, I'm not concerned for that reason, because to me, looking at the field, I see in some sense how shallow the current AI programs are compared to our own intelligence. The beautiful music that you heard at the beginning, a lot of it was quite beautiful, but it turns out that Emmy, like many other AI creativity programs, needs a human in the loop to choose which of its creations to present and recognize which ones are beautiful. So it might create, 50 kind of so-so pieces and one that sounds really good, and that's the one that we just heard. So I think there's still a great need for humans in the loop. Machines have not taken over yet the kinds of things that we most pride ourselves on, except in a few cases, for instance, with playing chess or playing Go, some games. But aside from that, I don't see computers as being our competitors yet. But again, there are some other things that I do worry about with respect to AI.
Right. And the moral and ethical questions, which we'll explore in detail a little later in the show. But Professor Mitchell, if I may, so much meaning held in one word when you say yet.
Exactly. That's right. Well, that's a big question. Can we ever produce machines that have the kind of intelligence, the broad and deep intelligence that we humans have? And I don't know the answer. I don't see any in principle reason why not, but I think we're still quite far away.
Well, so then that sort of is a different, quite a different take than what we hear frequently in the popular press, or even coming from certain leaders in tech. I mean, you quote several of them in your book, right? You have Shane Legge, co-founder of Google DeepMind, just a couple of years ago in 2016, saying human-level AI will be passed in the mid-2020s. Mark Zuckerberg, of course, of Facebook, saying one of our goals for the next 5 to 10 years is to basically get better than human-level at all of the primary human senses, vision, hearing, language, and general cognition. And then you also point to a 2013 poll of AI researchers that found that many of them said there was a 50% chance of human-level in AI by the year 2040. Are they wrong?
In a word, yes. So these kinds of predictions have been going on since the beginning of AI. Back in the 1950s, it was predicted that within 5, 10, 25 years, we would have full AI, and it was predicted by the leaders of the field. And yet, it turned out that they were completely wrong. And even one of the pioneers of the field, Marvin Minsky from MIT, later said that what we've learned in 50 years of research on AI is that it was harder than we thought, and that easy things are hard.
Right. That's the central conundrum, right? The things that a child can do pretty easily, learn how to talk, look around the world and describe what she's seeing, take in a little bit of information, as you point out, and learn new concepts with very little information. We're still far away from machine learning being able to do that.
Yeah, this is a well-known paradox in the field, that machines can do things that are very hard for humans, such as playing chess at a grandmaster level, or playing Go now, or diagnosing diseases and translating between languages. But the simplest things like describing a picture or engaging in a conversation like the one that we're having. Things that just seem so immediate to us are the most challenging aspects for AI right now. And no one knows how to get machines to do these things.
Well, so doesn't that raise the automatic question of what is intelligence when we're talking about it then? Because, you know, crushing you at Go or defeating Kasparov in chess, as you write, that those are sort of brute force computational achievements. But it's not, you don't really see that as intelligence.
Well, that's right. I mean, it's one of the things that AI has given us is a more nuanced view on what intelligence is. People don't really have a good definition of the term intelligence. It means so many things. Marvin Minsky called it a suitcase word, meaning that it's like a suitcase jammed with different meanings. You know, we talk about intelligence in so many different contexts, but we don't really know what we mean by it. And every time an AI program achieves something that we used to think of as intelligence, we then sort of redefine the term and say, wait a minute, that's not what we meant. So it's an evolving term. Part of the interest or the excitement in the field is really trying to figure out exactly what we mean.
What we mean by artificial intelligence or what we mean by human intelligence?
Yeah, that's the question. So artificial intelligence was a term invented by John McCarthy, who was one of the founders of the field. And he very much regretted calling it that later on because, first of all, the word artificial is misplaced. The goal was to create real intelligence, not artificial intelligence. But I think the question that you're asking is really, is there an intelligence that's different, say, from our own intelligence that computers could have that we could call artificial intelligence? And I'm really not sure if that's the case.
Interesting. Well, we are talking this hour with Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University and author of the new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. We'll have a lot more when we come back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University and author of the new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans, where she gives us a realist's view on the current state of AI technology and what's come before, and also gives us a sense to get a, gives us an ability to handle on what might come in the future. And actually, given the fact that I'm having trouble stringing sentences today, maybe the AI ought to come sooner than we think. So let me just go to a little bit of tape here about at least one time in the very recent past where a machine bested a human. This is from 2011, when Jeopardy stars Ken Jennings and Brad Rutter squared off for 3 days against Watson, IBM's supercomputer. And here is the moment that Watson won. The final Jeopardy question: William Wilkinson's An Account of the Principalities of Wallachia and Moldavia inspired this author's most famous novel.
Now we come to Watson. We're looking for Bram Stoker. And we find... who is Bram Stoker and the wager? Hello, 17,973, 41,413, and a two-day total of 77,147.
That's Watson winning at Jeopardy in 2011. And I believe Ken Jennings soon after that said, it's time to welcome our computer overlords. But Melanie Mitchell, for these sort of very public and popular moments aside, I'm wondering if you can take us back to You mentioned Marvin Minsky earlier, but that critical summer where some of the brightest minds in computer science came together and first sort of got us started thinking about, can we create an artificial intelligence? What happened that summer?
That summer, that was a workshop at Dartmouth College in 1956, organized by Marvin Minsky, John McCarthy, and several other people. And they laid out what the field of artificial intelligence was going to be about. It was going to be about getting computers to speak in natural language, that is human-like language rather than computer language, getting computers to be able to recognize visual images and describe what they saw in the world, to be able to deal with abstract concepts, to reason, to do all the kinds of things that we humans think of as intelligent. And they set aside 2 months, and they said it was a 10-man, two-month effort where people would gather at Dartmouth and figure out artificial intelligence. Of course, it didn't get completely figured out that summer or even in the 70-odd years since then. But it was very optimistic.
But are those sort of core, I don't want to call them tasks, but abilities that you just described, do they still sort of form the heart of what AI researchers are trying to achieve?
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, that exact same list that the Dartmouth group gave is still the forefront of AI research. In some sense, we haven't solved any of those problems at the level of human intelligence. So the field's still wide open. But of course, in a problem like intelligence, which is a very hard scientific problem, 80, 90, 100 years is almost nothing for research. So I think we're really still just at the beginning.
Okay. But what about for natural language? It seems like we've made major strides, even just in the past decade. We've got sort of natural language emulating machines in people's homes, in their pockets, in their cars. I mean, that seems to be quite a big advancement.
There has been some advancement, for example, in speech recognition, that is, computers that transcribe your speech. That's gotten a lot better. I mean, that's really impressive how well, you say, your phone can just transcribe a spoken text or email. But in the other areas of natural language, such as question answering, like you might have Siri or Alexa do, it's still quite limited. And anybody who's interacted with those systems knows that there's a lot of things they can't answer. There's a lot of things they don't understand. And in fact, the question is whether they actually understand anything in the sense that we humans understand it. And in some sense, they absolutely do not understand anything. You know, if you ask them about, an example I gave in my book is you ask them, how many gold medals did Usain Bolt win in the Olympics? It can look it up and to give you an answer, but it doesn't know anything about Usain Bolt or Olympics in the sense that we humans know about the way the world works.
Mm-hmm. So is this an example of how right now we're seeing artificial intelligence systems or machine learning systems doing very, very good jobs in what you call sort of narrowly defined tasks? Like AI is good at solving focused problems.
Yes, that's really where we are. AI is very good at certain very narrowly focused problems, such as speech recognition or game playing for certain games or translating languages to some extent, facial recognition, all of these things. But we don't have any machines with kind of the general intelligence that we humans seem to have.
So you're saying they're not thinking yet?
Well, the word think is hard to define. All of these words are very hard to define. But in the way that we normally use the term, I would say no, they are not yet thinking.
Okay. Well, on this point, let me just go to our callers very briefly. Let's go to Jim, who's calling from Omaha, Nebraska. Jim, you're on the air.
Hi, Meghna. Do you think the Turing test can ever be passed, or has it already?
Good question, Jim. Melanie Mitchell addresses this directly in her book. So Melanie, first of all, the Turing test, of course, Alan Turing's sort of definition on how we might know if true AI has fully flowered. Can you explain what the Turing test is?
Yeah, the Turing test is the idea is you have a human and a computer and a judge, so three different entities. The computer and the human both try to convince the judge that they are the human by talking, by conversation. They can't see each other. And if the computer can convince the judge that they're a human, then they pass the Turing test. That was Turing's original idea. And we've had many computers that have, in some sense, passed the Turing test. We're fooled all the time by chatbots that sound very human-like in short bursts. And people are very willing to believe that something that's speaking to them in what sounds like sort of reasonable language is a human. It's not hard to fool people. That's one of the things that Turing didn't anticipate, I think.
I have to say about those chatbots, though, from the perspective of this user, whenever they pop up, like I had this happen several months ago when I was on the website for an airline, and the bot popped up, and it just frustrated me. So I kept typing in, "You are a bot. You are not answering my questions." But it was very polite in return. But so is the problem with the concept of the Turing test what you just said, that Alan Turing underestimated or possibly he underestimated how easy it is to fool humans versus how sophisticated an AI would have to be in order to fool them?
I think so. One of the problems is that he didn't specify how long the test should last or what conversational topics should be allowed or who the judge should be and who the human should be trying to convince the judge that they're human. So all those details matter quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And there's been many staged Turing tests that computers have done quite well in, but most people in the field of AI feel that it's obvious that they're not humans, that they're computers. So I don't know if a sort of a correctly performed Turing test would work. I think that probably if you did it right, it would be a good test of intelligence. I like the Turing test, but I think it's hard to do it right.
You do? Okay, that's interesting because you ask in your book, you know, another one of these central questions about sort of how would we know if we've succeeded in making a machine that thinks, a thinking machine, right? And you ask, would it be required to have consciousness or self-awareness the way we as humans do? Or what, you know, really, what is the difference between simulated thinking versus true thinking? I mean, walk us through that. How would we know the difference?
This is a very old philosophical question, of course. And always the thing to ask is, how do you know that I'm thinking? How do you know that I'm not just simulating thinking? We talk and you assume that I'm a thinking human, but how do you know? It's impossible in some sense to know whether I'm a self-aware, thinking, conscious being or a zombie that just simulates it. But then there's the question, is there a difference? Is simulating thinking not thinking? What's the difference? And in the book, I talk about a conversation I had with my mother, who just has this very strong intuition that there's a difference between thinking, real thinking, and simulated thinking, because real thinking is done with a brain. And I kind of pressed her on it, like, what's the difference? And she really couldn't state it, but she just had this very strong intuition that brains are for thinking and machines could never have that property. And I don't really understand that argument completely, but I know that a lot of people have that very strong intuition.
Wait, so tell me a little bit more then, because this is – you don't understand that argument completely, meaning you think that we could arrive at a time where simulated thinking is – how do I phrase this without sounding kind of woo-woo, but simulated thinking is as human as human thinking?
Well, if you think about the way the brain works, that it consists of trillions of neurons, millions to trillions of neurons. Each neuron is kind of a little mini machine. It's getting input and processing that input and producing output. But somehow, together, out of these myriad little machines, we get what we think of as intelligence and consciousness and all of the things that go along with that. But if you're not a sort of a dualist and think that there's some special sort of thinking, non-physical thinking thing out there, you have to admit that your brain, everything in it is, in some sense, a little machine. And somehow out of that machine, those myriad machines, we get intelligence. So I don't see any reason why we couldn't have machines that have intelligence. It's just that the brain is extremely, extremely complex, and we don't understand very much of it. And so we can't reproduce it. But
can I just jump in here? So
yeah.
Intelligence or consciousness?
Both.
Both. Okay. How would we know when a machine becomes conscious?
Well, that's, I think there's no way to answer that except Turing kind of threw up his arms and said, how would you ever know? Well, the only way you could know is to define thinking or consciousness as passing this test. So maybe it's not the best test, but this kind of behavioral evaluation really is the only thing we have.
Interesting. Well, Professor Mitchell, your book definitely explores a lot of other philosophical and moral questions, which we'll come to, but it also walks us through the current state of where AI research and technology is. And I was wondering if you could just help us understand where we are today. So, for example, you talk extensively about deep learning or machine learning. First of all, define it. What is machine learning?
Machine learning is when a machine, in some sense, learns from data. So it helps to contrast it with the old-fashioned kind of AI where everything was programmed in. So if you want a machine to, say, recognize faces, a human would program in all the rules needed to recognize faces. But a machine learning program, on the other hand, is just given photographs of faces and has a way to figure out what features in those photographs are useful for recognizing different people. So today's most successful machine learning programs are called neural networks, which are computer programs that are simulating, sort of in a very rough sense, some aspects of how the brain works. And they learn in the way the brain learns, in that connections between neurons in the brain either strengthen or weaken. That's how the brain learns. And in these neural networks, connections between simulated neurons strengthen or weaken in response to getting these example photographs, for example, and being told by some human, yes, no, you're wrong, you're right, and gradually learning from those examples. So machine learning is really taken over all of AI. And deep learning is a form of learning with these very large neural networks, these very complex computer programs that simulate the way the brain learns.
So in that case, are these deep learning systems capable or could be capable of more than those narrowly defined tasks that we were talking about earlier?
This is the big question. Right now, even the deep learning systems, which are much more successful than the old-fashioned approach to AI, even these systems only succeed at narrow tasks. They're trained, like a facial recognition system is trained by being given millions of photographs of faces. and learning over many, many, many examples. But it, once it's learned to recognize faces, it can't recognize anything else. It can't do any other task. So these systems are, each of them is narrow. And the big question is, will these systems be able to be broadened? Will they be able to become more general, generally intelligent? And that's still an open question. Right now I'm attending one of the biggest machine learning conferences in the world. It's called Neural Information Processing Systems, because it's all about mimicking the way that neural networks in the brain work. And this is the real question that everyone's asking here, is how can we make these systems more general?
Well, we have to take a quick break, and we are talking this hour with Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University and author of Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. We'll be back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Seen. Listen and follow Last Seen wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Melanie Mitchell. She's a professor of computer science at Portland State University and author of the truly fascinating new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. We've got an excerpt of Professor Mitchell's book at onpointradio.org. And Professor Mitchell, if I may, I want to sort of play longer versions of the two bits of tape we heard at the very top of the show from Ray Kurzweil and Stephen Hawking, just to remind folks about how we've had very different views of what an AI future might bring. So first of all, here is inventor and futurist Ray Kurzweil. He predicted a singularity, as he called it, a fully functioning AI by the end of the next decade, in fact. And here he is repeating that prediction while speaking with Neil deGrasse Tyson in 2016.
Back to a book I wrote in the 1990s, The Age of Spiritual Machines, I predicted that...
Age of Spiritual Machines.
Yeah.
Okay.
By 2029, computers would have all of the intellectual and emotional capabilities of humans, and so they would be spiritual machines. And conversely, we are spiritual machines.
That's Ray Kurzweil in 2016. Now, contrast that to what Stephen Hawking envisioned. He envisioned kind of a much darker future. Here he is, I should say the late Stephen Hawking, by the way. Here he is during a BBC interview in 2014.
I think the development of full artificial intelligence could spell the end of the human race. Once humans develop artificial intelligence, it would take off on its own and redesign itself at an ever-increasing rate. Humans, who are limited by slow biological evolution, couldn't compete and would be superseded.
Stephen Hawking in December of 2014. Now, Professor Mitchell, I wanted to play those two again because they represent sort of the two poles of horror or hopefulness regarding our technological future. But is it possible that both of these great thinkers have it wrong? That what we really need to be thinking about is the effects that AI is having on us right now in terms of how it's forcing us to really assess what do we think are moral decisions? How can we be sure that these technological systems right now are acting ethically?
Yeah, I think most people in the field, working in the field, believe that neither of those either utopian or dystopian scenarios is realistic at all. we're so far from either of those. And, you know, there are people who say now we should be worried about AI, super intelligent AI taking over the world. But I like to quote Pedro Domingos, another computer scientist, who said it's not that super intelligent AI systems are going to take over the world. It's that our computers are too stupid and they've already taken over the world. And I think that's one of the problems. And we're using these systems to make decisions that perhaps they don't really have the intelligence to make. That's one of the worries that a lot of people have.
Okay, so let's explore that more, because as you ask in the book, you say, what assurances do we have, right, that machines that are making those news feeds in our social media or being used to diagnose disease, or we're seeing now, I mean, you point this out, banks using machines to make decisions on loan applications, that they're making trustworthy decisions. So I was wondering if you could actually read a little bit from your book, Artificial Intelligence, where you dive more deeply into this question of morality and ethics in AI.
Sure. So here I'll read a section on the question of whether we can give computers their own moral values. To my mind, progress on giving computers moral intelligence cannot be separated from progress on other kinds of intelligence. The true challenge is to create machines that can actually understand the situations that they confront. As Isaac Asimov's stories demonstrate, a robot can't reliably follow an order to avoid harming a human unless it can understand the concept of harm in different situations. Reasoning about morality requires one to recognize cause and effect relationships, to imagine different possible futures, to have a sense of the beliefs and goals of others, and to predict the likely outcomes of one's actions in whatever situation one finds oneself. In other words, a prerequisite to trustworthy moral reasoning is general common sense, which is missing in even the best of today's AI systems.
That's Melanie Mitchell reading from her new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. So how can we, given all the things that you just outlined that would be required for moral reasoning, is that something that we could ever achieve artificially?
Well, ever is a long time.
True. Okay.
But
fair
in
enough.
In the near future, I think, no, we should not be giving machines the autonomy to make their own moral decisions. We have to have humans in the loop. I think almost everyone in the field agrees with this. And more it's being seen that these systems that, for instance, you know, in the book I talk a lot about facial recognition and the ethics of that. These systems they learn, as I said, from millions of examples. They are very complex programs, and they can't really explain why they make the decisions they make. So it's hard to trust them. And people recently have been showing how facial recognition systems can be biased. For instance, they're better at recognizing people with light skin than with darker skin. And they're better at recognizing males than females. And other kinds of biases, they're better at recognizing young people than older people. So a lot of question has gone into, should these facial recognition systems be used, for instance, in law enforcement? And it's been seen that more and more cities have been banning their use in law enforcement, although other cities are taking it up. So this is now a big kind of ethical question for humans, not for machines, but for humans, is how do we use these systems? How much do we trust them? How much autonomy should we give them?
And another example would be, or one of the many examples, with self-driving automobiles, right? Self-driving vehicles, because you talk about how there's the very famous trolley problem, right, with self-driving vehicles, in terms of what decision should a car make if there's about to be a crash, right? Should it make a decision, say there's help me through this if I'm doing this right.
Right.
If there's like five pedestrians in front of the car and the car can make the decision to hit the pedestrians and save the driver, quote unquote driver, or it can make the decision that might cost the driver or passenger their life but save the five pedestrians.
Right. I mean, people have pointed out that, this kind of scenario is doesn't come up really in real life, but it's a thought experiment that is about how do you make moral decisions when you're acting in real time. And self-driving cars, there was a survey done on people about whether machines, you know, they would want a self-driving car to save a pedestrian and risk the driver's life. And most people said yes, they wanted it to save pedestrians, unless it was their car. They wouldn't buy a car that was tuned to save pedestrians above the driver's life. So not everybody sort of has the same moral values when their own life is in question.
Interesting. So I guess what you're asking us to really wrestle with is sort of the questions that the development of AI forces back upon ourselves about, like, what do we think is moral? What is ethical? And how can we be sure that we get those values into the technology we're developing? On that note, I mean, it's easy for us to sort of naturally think about AI development in the United States or the Western Hemisphere. But obviously, this technology is being grown around the world. And I'm specifically thinking about China. So let me just play a little bit of tape here, because at the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence, the conference in November, New York Democratic Senator Charles Schumer was there, and he said that he believes the United States is falling behind other nations when it comes to its commitment to AI development, and he raised a couple of other nations as a comparison.
President Putin has said that the nation that leads in AI will be the ruler of the world, and he's made his intentions clear. China runs a massive surveillance state that relentlessly tracks its citizens, controls the flow of information, suppresses minority views, and brutally punishes dissent. So we need not to have their motivation or their way, but we need to match and exceed their level of commitment, which thus far we have not done.
So, Professor Mitchell, you're in this field. You're a computer scientist. I'm wondering what you think about the fact that a lot of the future developments in AI may likely come out of China, may likely come out of an authoritarian state whose motivations for creating this technology are different.
I find it terrifying. I find that really to be a real danger that we should be worrying about. And I don't think it's just China. I think even here in the U.S., there's a more and more sort of view towards surveillance and using AI techniques for things that might disturb people, that might impinge on civil rights and so on. But China is a, you know, the example that everyone uses, and they're using AI in a very terrifying way. So this is something that I think we AI researchers are now having to grapple with, that we never really had to grapple with much in the past, which is, how are our creations actually being used? Is it in a way, is this something that we really should be creating and allowing to be used in these ways? So I think people in AI are now, have a lot of people have become sort of dual roles as scientists and also activists, trying to talk about the need for regulation and for moral uses of these technologies. But like any technology, you know, it can be used and it can be abused, and it's hard to control once it gets out.
We've just got about 4 minutes left here, Professor Mitchell, and I'm wondering if we could just sort of, in a sense, circle back to where we started, because at the end of the book, you ask several sort of key questions to leave us thinking. One of them is, as we've been exploring, how far are we from general human-level AI? What is your answer to that?
Very far. One of the things that we've learned from AI, sort of paradoxically, is how complex human intelligence is. We've learned that, as Minsky said, easy things are hard. The things that are the most easy for us are the hardest for for machines. In fact, interestingly, a big push in the AI community is now on what's called common sense, machine common sense. And one of the grand challenges this has been set out is to produce a machine with the common sense of an 18-month-old baby. So that's something that people are working on. And it sounds crazy because, we have these computers that are able to translate between hundreds of languages, that are able to play chess and beat any human, that can do all these different things, diagnose diseases. And yet we don't have something with the common sense of an 18-month-old baby. So that kind of shows the how well we've done in narrow areas and how far we are from what we would call general intelligence.
Wow. I'm trying to think of how much common sense does an 18-month-old baby have.
a surprising amount, because they can walk around without usually crashing into anything, or they can recognize all kinds of visual input in the world. They know how the world works. They know how objects interact in the world. The things that are that we know that are completely invisible to us because they're just not conscious. And those are the things that really make us generally intelligent.
Well, the last thing, I just want to sneak this in if I can, because I love how you end the book. You say, "I hope that this book has helped you as a thinking human to get a sense of the current state of this burgeoning discipline, including its many unsolved problems, the potential risks and benefits of its technologies, and the scientific and philosophical questions it raises for understanding our own human intelligence. And if any computers are reading this, tell me what it refers to in the previous sentence, and you're welcome to join the discussion." Do you think one day a computer might recognize itself in that word?
I think someday it will, but as one person said, general AI is 100 Nobel Prizes away, which is a nice way of describing sort of the discoveries that are going to have to be made in order to get to that kind of goal of computers being able to recognize themselves.
Really? I mean, I still have a little bit of lingering doubt, because doesn't Moore's Law say that we're going to get to places much faster than we think we are?
Well, remember, Moore's Law is about hardware, not software.
Oh, okay. Good
point. That's an important distinction.
And I guess we'll wrap up with that distinction, offered by a computer scientist, a professor of computer science at Portland State University. We've been speaking with Melanie Mitchell. She is author of the new book, Artificial Intelligence, A Guide for Thinking Humans. And we have an excerpt of it at onpointradio.org. Professor Mitchell, it's been truly a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a great conversation.
On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Eileen Amada, Stefano Katsonis, Wes Martin, James Ross, Dori Scheimer, Alex Schroeder, Grace Tatter, and Adam Waller, with help from Sharif Campbell, Jeffrey Line, and Sydney Wertheim. Our executive producer is Karen Schiffman. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.